For me, it's really a pleasure to talk about this project, but in particular, it is a pleasure to talk about it now that we actually have some results to show. And I'm a member of the Dark Energy Survey Collaboration, and as part of the effort of our collaboration to study cosmology, we built a camera called the Dark Energy Camera, and that's the camera that our team uses to pursue follow-up observations of gravitational wave events. And so what I'm going to talk about today is a little bit about an overview of what is our program, what we do, and that journey that led us to being one of the teams that discovered independently the optical counterpart to the now famous GW170817 event. Let me just start by saying that this is a big team effort. I don't hope that you guys will internalize all these names that are here, but I just think that it's important to show that we have a team of people that includes not only members of the Dark Energy Survey Collaboration, but also a few members of LIGO and members of the community at large outside of the ES who have helped us as well obtain data sets in other wavelengths from other resources in the community. So it's a big team effort, and I should acknowledge a little bit that as well. I assume this is a pointer?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. I'm Brazilian, right? So it's like, yeah, this is alien to me. So let me start by showing this, which is, I call a menu of opportunities arising from the combination of gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations of the same event. There is something here in this menu for every taste. If your interest is astrophysics, understanding binary systems, the history of formation of this our process elements in the universe, or the equation of state of neutron star, there's something for you here. And in particular, the ones highlighted in bold are the ones that we managed to address, at least in part, with this one event. So I think it's a particularly rich area of expertise. Each item here is not only a thesis topic, but it's probably a full career for a person who would be starting today in this field. And in particular, cosmology is a topic that is closest to my heart, and it's the one that I'm going to focus more today. But I'm sure that some of you probably are more interested in topics that are in here instead. I feel like it's a little bit weird, this thing. I don't have to, this audience, I don't have to talk about the basics, but I will just highlight here that the basic principle here for using gravitational waves for cosmology is similar to any other distance redshift relation. We want some object or a sample of objects in the universe for which you have distance determination, and you want to put them in a plot like this and determine the cosmological parameters and tell if the expansion rate is speeding up or slowing down. Nature is kind enough to provide us multiple ways of doing this determination, and supernova are probably the most famous one, but also we all know we can use the cosmic microwave background, we can use the characteristic scale of interactions in the early universe as a standard ruler and do these measurements. And by doing that, we can compare the results that we obtain from measurements that are, let's say, local using the supernova and far using the CMB. And the most interesting part is that these results, they do not agree. So a long-standing problem in this field is that the more precise the measurements, the worse is the agreement. And what we have here, I'll try this side now, is that the Planck results, the latest and greatest measurements from Planck, they are disagreeing by two, almost three sigma already, with respect to the best results from the supernova measurements. And the answer here could be either there is something wrong and we need to recalibrate our standard candles, or it could be some new physics. And this is a plot that I took from this paper from Rees et al. And these arrows here show the new physics components that you put in, how much the CMB results, obviously the idea here, since this came from Rees et al., he wants to shift the CMB results to match with it, his. So for me, looking at this plot, my first thinking is, oh boy, it would be great to be able to add an independent data point somewhere here from a new independent measurement of distances. And question is, can we use this new way of listening to the universe? Can we use that as a new distance indicator to pursue this? So that was the motivation for me back in 2013 when the LIGO collaboration issued a call for the astronomical community. So I got a spam email from the AAS saying LIGO is preparing to start running in 2015. Astronomers who are interested in signing MOU agreements with them to receive alerts and pursue follow-up, please respond here. I threw away that email at first, but then at the time I used to live in Chicago and I had a long commute to Fermilab. And during that commute, as I had my coffee, I was thinking, I think the LIGO collaboration would not make this broad invitation if they were not certain that they were reaching enough sensitivity to actually see something. So by the time I got to the lab, I was convinced that this could be something at least to think about. And from that, I managed to convince a few colleagues within DES, and in particular, members of the supernova group. The argument was that, oh, this will be exactly like looking for supernova, but easier, there are not so many events, let's do this. And thankfully, they agreed that this was interesting enough to pursue, in addition to all of the exciting stuff that DES is doing. And in addition, we partner up as well with the UChicago LIGO group and with a few members of the community that were with the same idea. And we developed then a search, and we were on Sky pursuing follow-up observations of the first binary neutral star, binary black hole event that LIGO detected in 2015. Obviously, we didn't find anything then. But that was encouraging enough that we decided to do it again in this present season. And that is what is going to be the focus of the talk today. Let me just talk a little bit about what is the dark energy survey and what is the dark energy survey camera. In particular, I like to show this slide because it's a good excuse to show this picture, which is my favorite picture ever of the camera. What you're looking at is the focal plane of the camera with 62 CCDs. In total, we have 570 megapixel, and the camera can take an image of the sky that covers about 3 square degrees, so about this much sky in one shot. And the camera is installed on the Blanco 4-meter telescope, and as a member of the Dark Energy Survey Collaboration, I helped build it as when I was at Fermilab, and I'm very proud of it. The DES program covers multiple things. The main part of the program are the two top lines over there. It's the wide survey, cover a large area multiple times so that we can understand dark energy using galaxy clusters, weak lensing, and all those traditional methods. And the second part is supernova. We revisit 10 regions of the sky over and over again to collect about 5,000 supernova. And now there are the new programs, the gravitational wave program that I'm going to talk about today, and the neutrino program, which is similar to the gravitational wave program, but following up ice cube events. Now, the dark energy survey covers only 5,000 square degrees in the sky, and that's the darkest region in this map. But obviously, the gravitational wave events don't care that we chose these areas here to observe. What you're looking at here, each of these maps is a map of the coverage of DCAM on the sky, including DES observations and non-DES observations in 4 bands in the optical wavelength from G, R, I, and Z band. As you can see, the community at large is also using the camera a lot and covering a lot of sky, but not in a coordinated fashion. So for instance, in I band, you can see that there is a lot of gaps and areas that are not covered. So to try to mitigate this effect, I came up with the idea of this Mind the Gaps project, which my colleagues did not allow me to submit a proposal with that title. So it changed to Blanco Images of the Southern Sky. And the idea basically is to do a smart coverage of the sky. We got some nights in 2017 to do that. And now in 2018, we are proposing for more nights and also coordinating with other proposed surveys so that we can cover the sky more quickly. And
the star was the virtual, was it?
Oh, a very good question. No, the two stars over there are the two areas that we are going to prioritize in the observations of the next semester. Those are the areas that we are going to prioritize that are, let's say, in more dire need of coverage. And let me say, why do we care about covering this area right now? We care about that because we will have a new observing campaign for LIGO starting in less than a year from now. And during the observing season, what we do is we take new images and compare with reference images taken before. And having these images covering all sky allow us to make a more efficient program. I'll get back to that concept in a while, but that it's a good picture to have in mind. So here's a cartoon of how the program works. And for a while, all I had to show for this program was a cartoon. It's kind of exciting to actually be able to replace this with actual results, as you will see. So the cartoon starts up there on the top with the idea of two neutral stars merging. As we know, our colleagues in LIGO and Virgo are able to hear that, that's the green waveform there. And they issue a trigger. If we point our camera to that region of the sky, the idea is that we will identify something that will have a light curve somewhat similar to that. Again, this is a cartoon based in some old models for what the optical emission would look like. What you see in the y-axis is, can be, for the non-astronomers in the room, it's just a flux or brightness. And as a function of time, zero is the time of the merger in days. And the idea, at least for me, the dream was to combine this information into a Hubble diagram here, where the redshift would come from the optical signature, and the distance would come from the gravitational wave event, the gravitational wave data. So let's see how well we can convert this cartoon into a reality. For that, I will show another cartoon, which is what are the mechanisms that we expected to see and in this scenario. So here in this cartoon scenario here, after the merger, you have a black hole in the center, and you have multiple signatures happening there. One of them is the gamma ray burst, a short gamma ray burst produced by particles being accelerated by this intense magnetic field and going in a jet that's a vertical jet over there. And in addition, we expect to see as well something that we call a kilonova, which is isotropic, more isotropic type of emission that is resulting from the ejecta material from the neutron star, a small fraction of the total mass, that gets slingshotted away from the system and burns and basically forms a ball of fire that we can observe. In addition to that, later, at longer timescales, we expect as well, so the kilonova timescale is about up to about 10 days or 2 weeks. And in longer timescale, we expect that this ejecta, as it interacts with the interstellar medium, will also produce emission, for instance, in radio and other wavelengths.
How does this picture change, if at all, if the project, the object that's formed after the merger is a neutron star?
I don't think that this picture in particular changes too much. If the resulting thing at the center is another neutron star instead of a black hole, I don't think it changes much. Okay, so this cartoon was pretty much what was guiding us when we were deciding what strategy to use for the searches. This cartoon tells us that the emission that we expect is something that will have a time scale, a duration of about 10 days to 2 weeks. And from this as well, we can derive that light curve that I put there before that tells us that the brightness of this event will be about 100 times less than a typical supernova. And that gives us a measure of the challenge from the point of view of brightness. So it's something that is fainter than a supernova, not too faint in this scenario, but decaying rather fast. So it requires a follow-up program that is a little bit faster than a typical supernova program. Now, the challenge here, so from the point of view of the emission, that scenario didn't scare us. It was, yay, okay, we can do this, right? We have a big camera on a large telescope. It's great, we can do it. Now, the challenge was the areas to cover. What you're looking at here is the median area enclosing a probability. And on the, for you, left side is the case where you have only the two LIGO detectors. And on the right side, what you have is a case when you add the third detector. And here are the numbers. The median area is 500 square degrees. And in the case of three detectors, that improves by about, in average, by about a factor of 10. So that's the reason why we were so excited and anticipating that Virgo would come online to help make those areas more, let's say, viable. But even 55 square degrees, it's a significant amount of sky. And so quite a few people were skeptical that we were able to find find this. But again, we have to remind ourselves that we have the right instrument for this challenge. This is an image of the sky. So what you're seeing here is this small Magellanic cloud that has an area of about 3 square degrees. It was one of the first images that we took. So this camera has a great potential because for a camera of 3 square degrees, 55 or 60 square degrees, it's not crazy to cover. We can do it. If anybody can do it, I think it's us. How does this work? So this is a little movie that I hope will play. Yep. This is a simulated event, okay? No real data here. But it's a simulated event with the two detectors, the two LIGO detectors. And the white contours there are 50 and 90% probability. And the yellow footprint in the sky is the region where DES is located. We are the DES collaboration, so we're kind of DES-centric in that sense. And what you're seeing here as the time goes by is the observability regions in the sky as the night goes on, right? So based on this, so the first thing that we do when we receive a new trigger is to make this movie. And with that, we have an idea of, is the region accessible at all? So if it will be there in the northern hemisphere, probably not. And is it accessible in the beginning of the night or the end of the night? And what is the integrated probability that we can achieve? And this map is done without any constraints on scheduling of the telescope. We assume that we can observe the whole night, okay? So this gives you an idea of, it is challenging, but in this case, for instance, we would cover all of the, more of the 90% region for this event. I wouldn't say it would be easy, but we could cover that over the course of the night. So it's a challenge that is not unsurmountable by any means. Now, after we cover the area, how do we pursue the search? And here, this is very similar to what we do for supernova. The idea is to compare the image where you think the source is, the search image, with a reference image. Ideally, it's a reference image that you have taken in the past. In the real world, as I showed you before, we don't have pre-existing template images everywhere in the sky. So what we do in those cases of, let's say, desperation, is that we go back later and re-image the area to take after-the-fact templates. You don't want to do that if you can avoid it, but sometimes you cannot avoid it. And then what you do is you subtract the images, that's an example there, and then what's left is the source of interest. We have this set up to be done using grid resources so that we can process the images of that entire area that I showed earlier rather quickly. The idea is that if the trigger happens right now, we want to be on sky tonight, and by early morning or at the latest in lunchtime the next day, you want to have a list of candidates to look at. And so that we can distribute that to our colleagues that have spectroscopic machines or colleagues that have telescope time in other wavelengths like radio or something like that. And this is something that was a big success of this program, was to make sure that we could do this processing in this 24-hour time frame. And so as I mentioned, we were active in the 2015-2016 season. We produced a few papers from that season. What you're seeing up here is the map corresponding to the very first gravitational wave detected event. We did not find any optical counterpart. This one has an interesting story because, as you can see here, can you see here? Yeah. The event is going right through the Large Magellanic Cloud. And at the time, the LIGO collaboration did not provide information about the distance to the event. So there was a bet going on internally if it was actually an event in the LMC or behind it, right? So at the end, obviously, everybody kind of lost the bet because the distance was way far out. But at the same time, the final region was also no longer passing through the LMC because the LIGO collaboration provided an updated region. So now there was a little bit of an offset. But in any case, with the information we had at the time, we did these two analyses. The first analysis was just looking over the entire area in red. And the second analysis was a special one that if it were an event in the LMC, one possibility was that it would be a core collapse directly into a black hole as opposed to a core collapse into a neutron star. So what we would see would be a disappearing red giant in the LMC. So that was a fun project to look at these red giants, and well, all of them are there. No, none is missing. So season one was really fun and interesting. It was really exciting. And what about season two?
Sorry, you said you comment on the collapse of black hole as opposed to a neutron star because otherwise you would have seen,
Then otherwise it would be a supernova. And a supernova in the LMC, you don't need the cam to find. You can step outside and look up.
Why can I not have a supernova with a black hole left, with a neutron star left behind? I mean, what?
Okay. So the typical, let's say, the standard scenario for a core collapse is a red giant suffers the core collapse, and you have a core collapse supernova, type 2, and the remnant is a neutron star. That's the standard scenario. That scenario was excluded by the fact that you step outside and look up, there's no supernova in the sky. So,
okay.
Literally, I mean, we asked our colleagues that were on the telescope, can you please step outside and look up? The alternative scenario that would still be compatible with something in the LMC would be a collapse that is expected to happen about 15 to 20% of the cases where the system collapses directly into a black hole, so there's no supernova. So it just, the star literally just disappears. And there's been observations of disappearing red giants that it's very difficult to find, so the statistics are very, very bad. But the idea is that, okay, if it would be something like that, the evidence would be a disappearing red giant. Okay, so now on to season two. And so let's talk about the program in action in season two. We had two binary black hole events as well in season two. And we did follow them up as well, and analysis is ongoing. But I will skip that and jump to the part which I think you guys are more interested in, which is the neutron star event. So that happened at what was for me about 7:30 a.m. My local time in Chicago. I was moving that day to my new job at Brandeis University. And it was also exciting because we had just had a binary black hole event that week. So we were quite excited about following that one up, etc. But this clearly trumped everything else. So we dropped everything what we're doing. And we decided to put all of our resources and energy into following up this event. What you're seeing here is the sky map. So it's one frame of the video that you saw before. But now it's for the real event. The white contours are the 90% confidence area. And this map it's one frame showing the sunset time. So it's the beginning of the night. And as you know, so then this map, as it would, I don't have the video version of it, so you imagine a little bit. The horizon over there is going to creep in, and that region will go away within 1.5 hours from sunset. So it's challenging because the region will disappear, but the region is compact enough that we could cover this region four times over in that time. We covered it in I-band and Z-band. The idea is that with two bands, we could obtain color information if we needed that to distinguish from other contaminants in the area. And by doing two more passes in those bands, we could do overlapping exposures to avoid the gaps between CCDs. You don't want to miss your source in a gap, right? So the red hexes over there are the contours of the pointings that we did, the overlapping pointings. We had an extra complication here going on because as you can see, this is in the beginning of the night that it was reachable, but the DES observations were scheduled for the second half of that night. But we were able to set up a remote observing station at the lab and perform the observations remotely in the first half, and everything worked well and was great, it was beautiful. And so a few hours later, we get our reward. Here, one important thing to talk about is that so far I was talking about the process of doing the search. That was a process with very little human intervention. You take the search image, you add your templates, you subtract them, you find candidates, and you analyze them. Here, because this source was nearby, and that was a big difference between season one and season two, is that now distance information comes right away. That means that we could make a list of galaxies in this field and set a few colleagues to look at them. So we had our all eyes team that were looking at some of these images. And at some point, Ryan Chornock, our colleague at Ohio University, sent this colorful message to all of us. And the image you see there uses that very first exposure where he noticed the new source, and also two more bands that we took GNR so that we can have a beautiful color composite. So this was extremely exciting, and it was fun. And we were typing in our report to post to this network of teams. So there is an internal network where you post the observations that you did so that the other teams can also know what was done, and also it kind of asserts as well that you observed it first and independently and so on. So we are typing it in, and we see that somebody else posted it first. So our posting was the second one by, I think, 9 minutes or something like that. So that was a little bit disappointing, but overall, it's really exciting. I cannot complain. It's really awesome.
What is the bright object? The very bright object
in the center?
Yeah.
That's the galaxy, the host galaxy.
That's the host galaxy.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, good questions. All right, so this is a galaxy that's a well-known galaxy, NGC 2993 or 4993, has a well-known phone number, let's say. And not only you see the source that it's very close, so the separation here in, it's 10 arc seconds, which at that distance corresponds to 2 kiloparsec separation. So it's really in that galaxy. And
so is that the only transient that was seen across the area that you surveyed?
I'll get to that. Yes, I'll get to that. So that's really one of the things. So how do we know that this is the one, right? Yeah. So so everybody was extremely excited about this. It felt like, okay, looks like it's at the right distance, the galaxy is at the right distance. And it looks great, it's awesome, let's just throw all our resources there. But then comes the question of how do we know that this is truly the source and not something else? So what we did was then look everywhere else. And as it turns out, so the sky, oftentimes we think of the sky as something that is static and not ever changing. But this sky is actually quite active. It's changing. There are transients a lot. So in that region that we covered, and here you're seeing a zoomed in version of the map that I showed before, white contours are the same white contours as before. Now the dashed lines are the new map that the LIGO, as usual, after their online analysis, they do an offline analysis and they improve their localization area. So they change the map a little bit. But this time, as you can see, their changes were much less significant. And in this entire area that we searched, so the red contours there, there were 1,500 things that went blip. And down to magnitude of 20.5. We can see much fainter than that, but in this case, we cut at that magnitude also because we wanted to cover the entire area very quickly. So, and so what we did here was try to, how can we select without and select what really are credible candidates? So first thing we do is to make sure that the same candidate appears in both exposures, in I and Z band. That helps us because those exposures were taken a few minutes apart. So if it's an object that moved from here to there, would appear as a spot in one but not in the other, so it would go away. And also, yeah, that's the main one. It could reject some glitches as well, but the main reason for that cut is to remove moving objects. Yeah, I have numbers here. So it goes to, yeah. So many. So that is like a factor of many. Then we have machine learning code the machine learning score code. That basically what it does is to reject bad subtraction artifacts that appears in the image sometime. So quite a few of the candidates go away by tightening this machine learning score. We train this machine learning on supernova data, and this is something that has been in use for the supernova searches for a long time, so it's well studied, and we know that we have an acceptance and efficiency of greater than 99% for this in this regime.
Is it a black box, though, this machine learning? And then, so do you have some idea about like what criteria it's using to reject?
There are many criteria, and described in a very boring technical paper, but it includes things, for instance, like the shape of the source. So a well-subtracted source will look like a point source, right? And something that was poorly subtracted will often look like a dipole because it was offset from each other, or like a donut, or some other complicated shape. Another one is the presence of residuals that are above a certain level that you expect for the signal to noise of that image, wings that you could expect from the PSF, and so on. So there are several criteria that are put in place. There is a training that is done using simulated data, and also in the early days, so you know that in the early days of supernova searches, it was very common for people to use just humans looking through and scanning the images. So a lot of work was done years ago in having groups of people scanning through and having the machine learning code run and adjusting the weights given to each of those criteria to achieve the optimal score. We don't redo this here because it would be too much work. We just use exactly as it was there. And finally, this is the cut here. So at this stage, you have 81 candidates. And this is a cut that removes 80 of those and leaves only the one candidate that we want, that is the source. And this cut is the one where the model, the expected model, comes into play. We say we expect this thing to be more of a kilonova than a supernova. And the main difference between the two is the fact that the supernova is a long-living transient that has a time scale of a month, While this is a short-lived candidate that has a timescale of up to a week or 2 weeks. So in this case, we revisited the entire area 2 weeks later, and we require that the flux of those candidates fade significantly enough that it is consistent with a timescale of 2 weeks as opposed to a longer timescale. Does that make sense?
Why did you pick 2 weeks? Why not a month? Why 3 months? I mean, how?
Because
that is a
very good question. The reason for that, because that was the last moment where we could still see the region, because remember the region was setting. So 2 weeks later, that region was even closer to the horizon in the beginning of the night. So if we could, so the ideal scenario was that we should have waited maybe much longer, or revisit it again after 3 weeks, after 8 weeks, or something like that. But in this case, it's not possible. So that was, we were limited by the fact that the sky is just not available. That part of the sky is no longer available for us because it's just too close to the sun.
Well, for DECAM, for other telescopes, like Australia or something.
No, it's really close to the sun, so anywhere. The sun is a problem, yeah. Yeah.
This is an important problem, we should put this
on. Yeah. Okay, so does that make sense? Yeah, okay.
Because you're saying that 2 weeks later you wouldn't be able to see it. But that doesn't mean that it's faded, right? It could be that the emission of photons is still significant after.
No, so 2 weeks later, there is only one of those 1,500 objects that went boom, bright. There's only one that's left. Everything else, there is only one that decayed completely in that time scale, right? All the other ones that were that passed the previous cuts were still there, so it's the other way around.
Yeah. Okay.
Know what I mean?
Then why not keep all 81? I still don't see what keeps the 2 weeks cutoff. You're saying if it's observational, that's just the prejudice that you put in by hand.
Maybe I missed something. Suppose you did all that, and you have another one that still hasn't faded by 3 sigma over 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That could inform, perhaps tweaking a little bit the models of the kilonova or the optical depth. And there's a lot of things about opacities that we don't know, and they know they are side events that they are not telling us.
Okay.
So maybe there is a.
If the true source would have some decay time scale, that would be. Something else.
Right.
Yeah.
So
okay. There is an assumption there that is based on the model. We don't expect that to be longer lived than that. Yes.
If you relax that assumption, then would you keep all 81?
No, because looking at those events, a lot of those are, for instance, variable stars. You know, so something that would vary a little bit.
Yeah.
Exactly, and things like that. This cut, it's very good to just clear it out and remove all of that at once. But probably if you were to relax that, we would have to go back, revisit the area more with more more frequent cadency in between. So that we could see that if it's a variable star or something, or compare with a catalog of variable stars or something like that.
Or if not, maybe if you see they take the presence of lanthanides or something.
Yeah, then you would take another option, would be 81 candidates, it's not too many. You could farm that out to a spectrograph and then take spectra, and then you would see, this is a vanilla supernova, this is a vanilla variable star, because those spectra have been studied a lot. So they are that would be another approach, exactly.
Can I just double check? So the 81 candidates, let me just check, some of them were brightening.
They could be brightening, yes. I didn't check for that, but they could be. Mm-hmm. So there's one type of candidate that could pass this cut, which would be slow movers. So something that would be moving too slow to be cut on cut number one, could survive that. But they are very, very rare at those magnitude limits. So, yeah. So that's another thing that in the future for searches that go fainter, we probably want to be more careful about that too. Okay, so so this analysis of the entire area helped us build confidence that the source that we found was actually the one that we were looking for. The orange spot over there is the location of that source and the coordinates. And one of the reasons why we went to the trouble of building this analysis was that in the future, when we see these events at further distances, the number of galaxies that could be the potential host galaxy will be too large for us to have a team of people looking through them. Today, this was okay because there were just like maybe a dozen or two dozen of them. But in the future, if you're talking about a distance that is 5 times or 10 times larger, the number of those galaxies start to become not doable. And the second is that my goal is to use these events for cosmology, and I want to put that in the distance redshift relation. If I use the distance information to select the candidate galaxies that I'm going to look at, then my redshift gets, the whole thing gets circular, and I cannot do that, use that for cosmology. For this first event, it's all fine because it's one event and it's great and beautiful. But in the future, when you want to do this and use that for cosmology and put a data point that is competitive with supernova, we probably want to do this in a more independent way. And this is why the motivation for this strategy. Now, once we found the source, other than wait for 2 weeks to go back and revisit the entire area, we also used the time during these 2 weeks to revisit the spot of the source pretty much every night. Every night that we could, we did it. What you're looking at here are the magnitudes as a function of days since the trigger. Each color corresponds to one filter. U band is in the 350 or so nanometers, and Y band is the reddest we can see. It's about 1 micron. And what you can see from here is that, I mean, for me, the really exciting part about this is that the cartoon that I showed earlier was not completely wrong, right? At least qualitatively, what we are looking at is very similar. It's something that is decaying in a time scale that is of about 10 days or 2 weeks, depending on what filter you're looking at. In the redder wavelengths, it lasts longer. There's still some flux. In the bluer ones, the decay rate is faster. The solid lines you're looking at there, they are what we would expect from just a black body that is cooling down. And it looks like, at least for the first few days, that is a good approximation for what is going on. And I think that this is really beautiful because it looks like the assumptions we made, there are details, but in the big picture, was actually not too wrong, right? So that's really cool. So
sorry, can I go back to the question from before? So you did pick out this event before you did the 2 week follow up. So how did you pick up, or did you the spectrographic observation? You were following just one candidate.
Yes. So
how did you pick that one before you did the thing 2 weeks later?
So that candidate, the idea was that us and everybody, we were, okay, this candidate looks really tantalizing, right? Because it is at a galaxy at the right distance, and it is also the spectrum, and this type of light curve was also not consistent with a typical supernova, et cetera. So it's very likely the candidate. So we were talking about it as the candidate, not the counterpart. But we were following it up because if it turned out to be the candidate, the counterpart, then we wanted to get as much data as possible for it. So we tried to get as much photos as possible.
Can I just double check on the 81 candidates as well? I mean, they're uniformly throughout the entire sky region.
Yes, I don't.
So they're not localized on the galaxies within the volume.
We do have. One of the things that we implemented was an algorithm where we take the galaxy catalog and do matches to find the hosts of those candidates, and they have hosts, but they have all of them have and I looked at this as well. Their hosts are at higher redshift, you know, faint galaxies way far away. Yeah. So that was, let's say, one of the things that was in my list of cuts to try to remove was the redshift of the host. If something is matching a galaxy at redshift 0.5, then it's not the thing. But before I got there, well, I ran out of candidates, so we didn't include that host, that cut in the analysis.
No, but going to the question, you sort of did, right? Because the first night, there was a list of 50 galaxies that were in the localization volume. And you, so by eye, you'd actually excluded all of the high redshift.
Yes.
So in a sense, the algorithm described as the offline processing.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened?
Yeah, so the algorithm I described is, yeah, it's the offline process, and it ignoring the fact that we think that that candidate is a candidate, right? We just throw it in and apply the cut, yeah. So now, this is in broader terms, it looks like a kilonova. It looks like what we expected. Now, in detail, the picture gets a little bit more complicated. This slide is out of order. I just wanted to say here, just give a list of the pieces of information that we get from the gravitational wave data alone. And pieces of information, they are used as input for the models that are done in more detail. And so basically the total mass is between 2.7 and 3 solar masses, so consistent with 2 neutron stars. And in a merger that where the ratio of the masses is comparable to each other, and so on. So this is just from the LIGO fact sheet about this event, okay? And here is the result of the analysis, the more detailed analysis. So for this analysis, we use the data points that I showed before that came from our camera, plus data points from HST data using infrared, and also spectra obtained with Gemini and with the Gemini telescope. And here, so the details are described in that paper up there. And here what we have is basically that cartoon, it's just too simple for this event at least. Here, to explain that light curve, we need two components for that kilonova. One component that is fast and fast in blue, and also that has less mass. That's the blue component, and that's so you need these two components to explain the difference between the evolution timescale in the bluer filters versus the red filters. And so the idea is that you have one component that is going to be ejected much faster than the other, and that has less mass. So it's at 30% of speed of light, and has about 1% of a solar mass. And a second component that is more massive, 4 times more massive, but slower, just 10% of the speed of light. And that slower component is the red kilonova, the more traditional, what our cartoon was showing early on, okay? So it looks like the picture is a little bit more complicated, at least for this event. And obviously, the next thing we want is more data to see if this is typical or not.
Why would LIGO fifth-rev letters on the gravitational wave measure?
Uh-huh.
What distance of 40 megaparsecs plus or minus roughly 0.4? So you report a bigger distance.
That was in
light years. Yeah, because that was from the fact sheet, so this was in light years. So 40 megaparsec would be
130 million
light years,
yeah.
Plus minus 10, 8 or 10.
What's the total mass?
Yes.
2.73
plus or minus. An error bar, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in this case, for instance, one question that we have is if these light curves can actually have a hint there for what orientation angle you're looking at. Because it could be, so one of the things that this data is not conclusive in this case is whether or not you're looking at the system face on, right, or in an angle or something. But it could be that if you would be looking at it completely face on, you would be seeing only one component more brightly, and then the other one would just be buried, and vice versa. So it could be that the, let's say, the idea that of a blue and a red component and how much of which of them, or linear combination of the two you have, could have an indication of what would be the orientation that you're looking at. But it's for now, that's the only speculation we don't have.
Could it also be rotating velocity?
That as well. That to make things even more complicated. So this is really exciting and fun. It's the first time that we observe such a system, and it's great that we are able to do it in so great detail, and helps us start to understand, raise more questions than answers. But it's I think that's the way it goes. Now the next thing we can do, now that we excluded, let's say, the possibility of other candidates in the area, we monitor the source and model it. The next thing we can do is try to understand the environment. And this paper here is a paper that we did, trying to do an interpretation of the environment based on our own data. What you're looking at here is a detailed look at the galaxy. And there, it's the same thing, but with Hubble data. And here, the way it's done is to highlight the fact that this galaxy looks like just an elliptical galaxy, right? It didn't have any particular, anything special going on. Except that if you look at it in detail, you can see that there are these shell structures. And these shells, they can be interpreted as evidence for recent merger between this galaxy and another minor galaxy, something that didn't disrupt it completely but left these structures. And by the fact that this event is located at a position of one of those shells indicates that it could be that this binary system had its evolution aided or perturbed by this event that happened only 25 million years ago. So it's not clear yet if, at least from this data, it's not possible to conclude whether or not the binary was formed when it happened. But a more likely scenario is that the binary was already there and could have been disturbed and fell into a closer orbit so that they evolved and collapsed faster than they would otherwise. But this is more, how can I say? Again, more data would be needed.
The gravitational waves show no sign of eccentricity.
No, I don't think that there was any evidence for high eccentricity, no. It looks like, yeah.
Yeah, it's another circle. Mm-hmm.
But the time scale of circular rise is tiny compared to these four time scales, right?
Yeah, but I'm not sure how much the perturbations I was trying to think of. If I can use that to bound the perturbation that this merger would have produced.
Yeah, I don't know. So this is, I thought it was an interesting, another type of interesting question that we can try to address with the electromagnetic data that it's not possible otherwise. All right, so now on to the cosmology, which is the part that, I don't know about you, but it's the part I have been waiting for. What you're looking at here is the cosmological parameters inferred from the gravitational wave data. And as you can see, in comparison to the Ries et al. Results or the Planck results, these are not competitive at all. Yet, let's put it that way, not competitive yet. So the banana-shaped region here, you can see on the x-axis is the H-naught, and on the y-axis is the viewing angle. Okay, the inclination angle. And this is the major, at this stage of this program, this is the number one source of uncertainty. And if we could constrain that, we could shrink that and make the measurement better. As it is, what we have here is a distance uncertainty from the gravitational wave data alone that is about 15%. And on the so to get the Hubble parameter measurement, as I mentioned earlier, we want to put this in the Hubble diagram, right? So getting the redshift is important. And the redshift has two components, the cosmological component we are interested in, and also the peculiar component, which at these distances is significant. So one thing that has to be done is subtract that. And we did that using spectroscopic data of that group of galaxies. And that's what produces this result. And the best fit parameter measurement is 69, which is, honestly, we cannot tell if it's consistent, more consistent with one with the or the other. Now, one thing that we could do right after that, and this was done with our collaborators that have X-ray observations of this system, is can we use that X-ray information to infer or to restrict more the angle and improve this measurement? And the answer is a little bit, not much, right? But a little bit. So this, what you're looking at is, so the important plot maybe is the bottom one. With the, what is it? Yeah, the dashed line is the original measurement. So it's the one from the previous plot. And the blue line is what you get with an angle of 15 degrees and an off-axis viewing angle of 25 to 50 degrees that you can infer from the X-ray data. The green one is what you would do with a 5 degrees, so if it would be an even narrower opening angle. And so I think, for me, this bodes well for the idea that in combination, in the future, when we get many, many events, combination of observations in the optical with the gravitational wave data, perhaps with observations in other wavelengths, that all of that together will make this program a competitive measurement. Here already, there is significant improvement. And again, with one event, I don't want to say too much, but I think it's quite interesting that once you apply the viewing angle information that we have for this one event, looks like we are agreeing more with supernova than with CMB. Okay, fine, but come on. A girl is allowed to dream. I mean.
What opening do you need? Suppose you use the opening angle of 3 degrees, just to throw a number there. And you're seeing it on an off-axis angle of 10 degrees. How sharper?
Yeah, so this is what we were trying to show with the green curve. So the green one is if you improve from 15 to 5.
Just five. So, what assumption are you making about the observation angle?
So the idea, let me see. Yeah, so here was varying only the opening angle prior, but still the same relative angle of observation. Yeah, that was the idea. And again, it may, what I really would like to do is to be able to translate this into some information about in the optical light curves, because then we could do everything with the optical data and it would make the program a lot cheaper in terms of telescope time and resources, you know, and it would make it more viable for many events.
How many events would you need? Let's say the...
Great question. I have an answer for you, and it's coming in a couple of slides. Yeah. So let me go back here to my cartoon story. I'm really excited about the fact that I finally can show something that's more than a cartoon. And we actually have real plots, real measurements to put in here. And I'm really excited about having more of these events until the point where we're not talking about event by event anymore, but about samples and large numbers, and it will be great. Now, how large a sample? And that is what I'm showing here in this plot. So what I did here is scale up. So this is a cumulative number of events. And I'm scaling this up using the following assumptions. Up to now, we had two seasons. One of them was 3 months long. Another one was about 9 months long. And the range of out to which we were sensitive was about 80 to 100 megaparsec. That was the LIGO detector's range. Assuming that with the improvements that they are putting in place right now, they will improve that by that distance by a factor of two. That's what is quoted in some of their projection papers. And that assuming as well that the next season will last one entire year, then we can estimate how many more events we will get. So two cubed number of events more than what we have today. And then so on and so forth. They have, let's say, a roadmap of improvements that they plan to do. And so I took from there and I made this plot. So as you can see, we are in the lands of onesies and twosies, right? One supernova event and four to be precise, black hole events. And here I stopped the plot at 2022 when the LSST survey will come online. So that's the next generation big optical survey. And by then we expect to be in the lands of, 50, 70 events for neutron stars and hundreds of binary black hole events if this holds, right? So there could be variations here, but that's based on the latest numbers. That's what we get. And the solid line here is the really exciting part, which is today we have an uncertainty on H0, which is about 15%. That's what the y-axis in this side is showing. And if I just do square root of numbers, we are talking about similar level of uncertainty that we have today with supernova being achieved with the neutron star events. And I think that this is really, really great. I'm planning to print this plot in very large and put it in my office for the moments of frustration to be looking at it.
Do you think we'll be able to improve on that, or what is the LSST? Do you have any idea how LSST
will do? So LSST has a camera with a field of view that is has an area three times larger than our area on a telescope that's almost twice as large. So it can cover deeper and faster. Also, LSST will be on sky. The plan is to cover the entire sky that's visible from Chile. So no more gaps to worry about. It will be all uniform and nice and pretty. And with a setup that is pretty much made for detecting transients, classifying them, and so on. Nobody had, I think, until recently put in that picture the gravitational wave events, but now it's not so hard to do that. So part of what I'm doing right now is actually working on trying to see what tweaks we need to do in the strategy of the observing strategy for LSST to make sure that we detect as many as possible of these events. But it should be, So LSST is just the next generation from what we are doing today. Bigger, better, more expensive. So I think that this is really exciting, and I really hope that within the next decade, we will be able to put a new data point in that plot with an independent measurement and something that would be competitive. And if we compare how long it took for us to be able to do that with supernova, I think that this field is evolving extremely fast. And we are making progress at a pace that I think it's really exciting to see. And there are challenges. It's not easy. But it looks like we are being able so far to address those challenges, I think, quite well. All right. So this is what I have. And it's been great. This is for me, it's been a great journey. I'm learning a lot. I'm getting involved in this new community that's being formed in a way that it's going better than I expected, and I'm looking forward to do more. Thank you.
Questions? So what's the range for your camera in terms of the kilonovae? Like if it was exactly the same as the one observed, how far away could you have seen it?
We could see that one. We could see it out to 400 megaparsecs. So yeah, at the edge, beyond the edge of what LIGO will be able to see.
So you really don't need LSST in some sense then, right? I mean, you should be able to see as far as LIGO will be able to see for binary neutron star mergers with what you already have.
True.
The area you cover is much larger than the LSST, right? And then she was saying,
but she showed us that you can cover the air ellipse, which is only going to get smaller in one night with this.
So with, okay. There are different things. So with, let's say, to keep up with the rate of events, we are, right, by 2022, the rate of events will be so large that I think it will be hard, unless if we say, okay, let's take over the Blanco and let's do only this. Let's not do any other science with this telescope, and let's, which I'll be up for it, right? I mean, I would love it. But I think that other members of the community would not be so happy. If we were to do that, then I think we could build a program where we could keep up, maybe not keep up completely with the rate, but get close to it. But as it is, I think it would be challenging to keep up with the rates. And the other thing as well is, okay, this one was one example. I don't know if all of them will be as bright as this particular one. And if they are not this bright, then it becomes more challenging, it becomes more difficult. One here, one there.
So how does the magnitude of the event actually compare to the magnitude of the host galaxy in this thing?
Oh, very good question. So this, the absolute magnitude of this event at peak was minus 16, and the absolute magnitude of the galaxy, I think, was minus 13. So it is this galaxy is at the core is quite bright.
The question is then, I'd expect that a lot of these neutron star merger events would be happening in the galactic core where they get washed out essentially. So is there a sense of how many events are just going to not be observable because of that?
Yeah. So this is part of upgrades for O3 is to study that a little bit more. There are two problems there. One would be if they are just too faint, right, on top of the galaxy. And the other one is that the subtraction artifacts, the one that the machine learning code rejects, we find a higher failure rate if the surface brightness underneath the object is too bright. So, for instance, if this same object would be at the very center of the galaxy, it would be harder. This one, it's bright enough that probably would be okay, but it would be harder. So one of the things that is an active area of research is to improve our difference imaging aspects to deal with that. You've had a
question. So I was wondering if the distance uncertainty for this event will be typical for future events. So you're saying that the orientation of the spiral is near the density.
Mm-hmm.
So normally, I guess you would think that the polarization gravitational waves would tell you your orientation, right? So for this case, was that not dual because it was in the little blind spot?
Okay, so you're going a little bit off. I'm not a member of LIGO, so I don't know exactly everything there,
right.
But I think,
okay, so
yes.
Random parts of the sky, not
with more detectors. So what I know is that with more detectors, one of the reasons why everybody's looking forward to Kagra or the next detectors is that this adds information that can help break this degeneracy.
That's right. But before that, even, most events that we see just using Virgo and LIGO,
uh-huh,
most of them won't be in the blind spots, you would think.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, then, presumably, then the...
could be better.
Yeah, okay, so therefore, mm-hmm, this error actually might be atypically large.
True, but at the same time, this event was... in the other two detectors, it was very high signal to noise, very bright. And so for the other ones that are further away, I don't know, that's why I'm iffy here in my answer, because I don't know if at that regime the fact that it's low signal to noise in all of the detectors wouldn't outweigh that.
Because the LIGOs, two LIGOs are aligned, you don't get polarization.
Okay, so, yeah, all right.
one result is the detection of gravitational waves appear. The momentum waves within 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't count. Did you say anything about the detection?
Okay, so I think the question is about the delay time between the gravitational wave signal and the gamma ray burst signal. Okay, so the interpretation for that delay is that the gravitons, it just can propagate through material that's still opaque to photons. And that gives you that little head start there for the gravitons to propagate. So it looks like that there was a lot of physics happening in those first two seconds that before the system became transparent enough for those photons to propagate. That's I think a way to interpret that.
Okay.